Welcome to the Human Performance Podcast. Here we talk about everything to do with human performance and how leaders and organizations can get the best out of themselves and their people. I'm your host, Alex Young. My guest on the podcast this week is Randy Gage. Randy is a thought-provoking, critical thinker who will make you approach your business and your life in a whole new way. Randy is the author of 14 books translated in 25 languages, including his recent worldwide bestseller, Radical Rebirth. He's spoken to more than 2 million people across 50 countries and is a member of both the Speakers Hall of Fame and the Direct Selling Hall of Fame. When he's not prowling the podium or locked in his lonely writer's garret, you'll probably find him playing third base for a softball team somewhere. We discuss the role of health in performance, the power of routines, and the mental side of performance in reaching peak state. Hey, Randy, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
Hey, Alex, great to be on with you.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on. And having read through, you know, your amazing backstory and some of the books you've written and the speeches you've given, very excited to jump into a number of topics. But before I jump in with all my questions, it'd be great for you just to introduce yourself in your own words to everybody listening or watching.
Well, I guess at my essence, I'm a writer because I'm happiest when I'm in my lonely writer's garret, hunched over my MacBook Pro, typing out my next book. But I'm not a writer to write. I mean, I'm an entrepreneur. I'm out there in the space doing things, working with companies, working with leaders. And so my books are usually a reflection of that essence that I'm an entrepreneur at heart and writing. I guess I'm up to 14 books now. So I guess you could say I've kind of settled into that category of being a writer pretty strong.
Amazing. And what was, just for anyone listening, what was sort of the first thing that led you into business and your life kind of as an entrepreneur, even before you got into kind of writing?
I hated being broke. You know, I was raised by a single mother who raised 3 kids by herself back in the day when that was really quite uncommon. It's much more frequent now, but really was very uncommon then. And we were poor and I hated being poor. You know how you see these interviews on TV with movie stars or someone and they're like, "We were poor, but we didn't know it." I'm like, seriously? Because I knew I was poor and I hated it. And you kind of learn later on as I got more wise and sophisticated, I could put my finger on it and say, hey, to become wealthy, you have to practice leverage. You got to be able to scale things. And when I started, I couldn't really articulate that, but I knew at some level, I knew if I was just trading hours for money, I was probably not going to break out of poverty. And if I worked for people instead of doing my own thing, I probably would have a harder time becoming wealthy. So I think that was really the catalyst for me.
And it's very interesting. I mean, my kind of background, as we were just sort of talking about before we started recording, was I worked in a job in healthcare doing surgery, which was very much, working for other people, albeit, for something that was a very kind of for good cause. But I, probably very similar to yourself, was really interested in kind of business and having that kind of side hustle and not just doing my kind of normal day job, really. For you, how did you, start thinking, I suppose, like an entrepreneur, like you were going to go out on your own 2 feet and do something for yourself?
Well, I got subjected to the brutal realities of reality. I was a dishwasher in a pancake house where I started my illustrious career and, worked my way up and became a cook and a waiter and a host. And then I was a manager trainee and an assistant manager. And so, of course, my dream at that early stage of my life was if I could be a restaurant manager. I mean, they wore a tie. They had this huge ring of keys, which showed just how important they were. And they walk around. Hi, would you like some more coffee? How's your dinner this evening? I mean, oh, this was the dream job, right? This is like being one of the richest, wealthiest, successful people on earth. If you could be a restaurant manager at Howard Johnson's, which was the company I was working for at the time. And then I achieved that. And I realized, wow, I have waiters and waitresses who make more than I do. And they're here 40 hours a week because they get tips and they're making a good, you know, the good ones. If you're a, you know, the two professions that you really control your own destiny is like a waiter or waitress. You can you can out earn your colleagues 15 times, 10x, 20x, if you really are good at what you do, right? And being a salesperson, same thing. If you're a commissioned salesperson and, you know, you're really willing to apply yourself, you can just 10x, 20x, even 100x in that case, the people around you. And I had some good waiters and waitresses working for me, and they earned more than I did. And they were working 40-hour weeks, 35-hour weeks. I was working 90-hour weeks. And instead of doing the smart thing, which would probably be, you know what, I think I'll go back to being a waiter. I did the dumb thing and said, I should open my own restaurant. And then I could be my own boss. And I'm joking when I say that was a dumb thing, although it was the dumb thing because I didn't have the money to really do it right. So I was desperately trying to bootstrap it. My partner and I, you know, we just didn't have the kind of money. And so that didn't work out. And I actually did that twice in my life, started a restaurant, both times bootstrapping it. And, you know, without the kind of money I needed to do it right. And so it was, you know, a difficult go, but at least that's how I got into the entrepreneurial space and recognized, hey, I was halfway there knowing that, hey, it's better if I do my own thing, if I become an entrepreneur. But I had to learn the later part, which is, okay, make sure you know what you're doing. You have the skill set to make it work. You have enough capital to weather the initial storms, and then you can be successful.
And you know, not too dissimilar from something like healthcare, you know, the restaurant industry is a highly, you know, stressful industry to be involved with, period, especially if you're running your restaurant where kind of, you know, certain restaurant turnovers are very, very high and you know, the kind of serving and kitchen environment can be very, very kind of heated if you've got loads and loads of customers coming in. Did you sort of encounter elements of, you know, sort of stress and, you know, managing your own health when you were sort of going through some of these experiences early on?
Oh, in my restaurant days, I was smoking 2 to 3 packs of cigarettes a day, drinking 10 to 15 cups of coffee a day, 6 to 10 sodas a day, eating nothing but garbage. I wasn't running gourmet five, you know, Michelin star restaurants. I was running fast food, one level above fast food type restaurants where when the cook doesn't show up, you're the cook. You're short waitresses, you're waiting on tables. You know, when it's things are backed up, you're washing dishes. So I wasn't the pretty guy with the tie walking around with the coffee pot that I thought I'd be. I was, you know, and I worked for, like I mentioned, I worked for Howard Johnson. And I mean, it was such a competitive thing. You controlled your own payroll, your own P&L. You had to do your own P&L every month. And you called in your payroll every Friday and they ranked all the stores. And that was the only way you got promoted was were you running a good payroll and a good food cost. And so you just say, well, you know, I could send the cook home at 2 after the lunch hour. And then I could just cook the orders from 2 to 5 when the dinner rush starts. And I could save, you know, that much money for those 3 hours. And so it was, Yes, very. I mean, even before I was owning my own, even just running a restaurant, you know, as a manager working for someone else, it's a 6 day a week job, it was for me. And then your day off was, okay, well, I just go in today and do the orders and take inventory and make the schedule. And then if I can get all that done in 3 or 4 hours, then I can take the rest of the day off like real people and go out to dinner or go to movies or something like real people do.
Actually have a life outside of work.
Yeah. And I mean, that's... I mean, and I worked for companies where I was like, so I became like the training manager and the turnaround guy. So if they had a unit that was losing money, they'd say, Gage, we want you to take over Layton Avenue in Milwaukee. And can you turn that around? And so I was moving all the time. And so, yeah, I never put down roots, never could develop relationships, never, it didn't have a healthy lifestyle at all. So very high stress, very unhealthy life.
And how old were you in that sort of period of your life?
I was very young. So I had lied about my age to get a job because when I was a cook, they were opening up a Red Lobster in my town for the first time. And I wanted to be a waiter. But you had to be 18 years old because they serve beer and wine and alcohol. And I was 15 or 16 at the time they opened. But I always looked older and I could grow a mustache pretty early. So I had lied about my age to get this waiter job. And then when I got the waiter job, then I was working part time as a cook at night on the graveyard shift at another restaurant. And they were the ones that made me the assistant manager and then the, you know, manager. So I was managing a store when I was 16 or 17 years old. I was running a $1 million operation. They thought I was 20. So I was really, so that was from, I did that from the time I was like 16, 17 until I was like 30. So that was the first real decade of my life in the workforce.
Yes, it's interesting. It's similar kind of my journey because I left my role in surgery around about the same age, actually. What was your kind of transition after that? And was there sort of a particular, you know, moment or kind of like life event that sort of made you want to kind of move out of that and into something else?
Yeah, well, I had some help. I didn't have a choice. My restaurant was seized by the IRS, which is the...
Oh, wow.
The revenue people here in the United, Internal Revenue Service is what the acronym stands for. So I hadn't paid the taxes and the payroll taxes. So I had written a letter and said, hey, you know, I'm behind on the taxes. I would like to set up a payment plan. I need to get this right. And I just showed up at my shop that one morning and there were two guys sitting on a car, you know, in front of the front door. And when I went to turn the key, they came over and introduced themselves as IRS agents and they had their little documents and they said, well, we've looked at the amount of money you owe. You had like $15,000 in unpaid payroll taxes. And there's a 100% penalty on that because you didn't deduct them and deposit them. And then there's interest and there's late payments. And then there is this and that. And so we need $55,000 today, or we're going to padlock your restaurant.
Wow.
So I was like, I think I left my checkbook at home. I don't have $55,000. And they did. They seized the restaurant and auctioned it off at the courthouse. And so I had no, you know, and then I was owing that they auctioned it off for like $11,000. And I owed like 40 grand in change, which was like, might as well be $50 million at that point in my life. And so it forced me to, it was the, you know, one of the best things that ever happened to me. It was devastating at the time, of course. But it was one of the best things because that's what actually got me out of the restaurant business forever, hopefully, you know, that, because I didn't have a choice.
It's really interesting. I mean, we've spoken on the podcast recently to a number of people who've been through these, very traumatic and extremely painful, life events at the time, but then they've always reframed it to something that's very, very positive. Obviously, when that happened immediately, it must have been incredibly stressful, I can only imagine. But how did you then kind of, move on and sort of, learn from that and then obviously sort of get to where you are now?
I sold off my furniture item by item, was sleeping on the floor, borrowing money from friends. And I thought, I always wanted to be a writer. I always wanted to write a book when I was a voracious reader as a kid. And I thought, God, maybe I could go to school and become a writer. And so I had been expelled from high school. That's another chapter in my life. I had been a teenage alcoholic, teenage drug addict. So I went to jail for burglary and armed robbery when I was 15. And so I got expelled from high school. So I went and took the equivalency test and got the high school diploma and started taking some classes at the community college we have here in Miami. I got a grant, a scholarship to take classes. And so I started taking some classes. And I had made a little money in direct selling. That was how I had launched the first restaurant when I was like 20. I had like $11,000 I had made in direct selling. And so I invested that in this renting out this restaurant. And so I thought, listen, with all this money I owe, I could get a job as a manager at Denny's or something, and it'll take me 40 years to pay back all this money. I need to find a way to make much, much more money much quicker. And so I got back into direct selling, where there really was no limit. The bigger of team you could build and the more volume you could produce, the more money you made. And so that's where I turned. So I kind of was taking classes and I wanted to be a writer. And then I started reading about, Writer's Magazine and Writer's Digest and learned like you could write stories and submit them to newspapers or magazines and they might buy them. And so I wrote a story, an article, and submitted it to the Miami New Times, which is the alternative paper here. And they said, we want to buy it. It was like $120 they would pay for this article. I was like, wow. And so that was the first article I ever submitted. The editor said he was going to buy it. So that was it. My mind was made up. I could be a writer. I will be a freelance writer. And that's what I'll do along with direct selling. And the funny thing is he never did publish that first story. They just never found the right time. It was an article I'd written about a public beach we have here, which was kind of a drug area and there was a sex trafficking. And so I was, I wrote about it, kind of exposing it, and they just never felt the timing was right. But they had bought another story I had written after that. And that one was the first one published. And so I started writing and I started doing direct selling. And then I started training my team and then other people from other lines to say, hey, could you come and train our team? Or, hey, can we come and be your training? And then I became a professional speaker without ever really knowing that existed. And I'm kind of I'm a polymath anyway. I need to do three or four different things to keep my creative juices flowing. So that kind of worked out great for me. So I really have, for 30 or 35 years, I have made my way as an entrepreneur, never having to go back to work for anyone else and running companies.
It's an absolutely amazing story. And one thing I really want to touch on, and I know this is something that you speak about, in your books and your speaking and your own YouTube channel, just that whole kind of mindset of going through a huge kind of life changing event. And then your kind of attitude there was, you know, seemingly there was no kind of ego attached to it, because, you know, for some people going back to college would have been, you know, hugely challenging, and really thinking about what you enjoyed doing with writing and running that sort of on the side while you're, you know, doing direct selling to sort of, you know, pay your way through. Lots of people, you know, listening or watching might think, you know, how the heck do you do that? So, I mean, where do you think that kind of came from? What was your mindset at that time?
We have had an advice columnist. We used to have two. There was one called Dear Abby, and then her sister also wrote an advice column, and her name was Ann Landers. And I used to read, and we had these things, you'd have to Google it, but they were called newspapers, and they were delivered to your house every day, and they were like printed on paper, and, you know, you could go see one in a museum or something if you're not familiar with it. So we had these newspapers and this column, Ann Landers. I read Ann Landers' advice column every day. And so there I am, I'm 30 years old, I'm in debt, I'm selling my furniture, my whole life has been a disaster. And somebody writes her in a similar kind of thing. And they were talking about, you know, I could go back to school, but, you know, how old am I going to be 5 years from now? And her response was to the lines of, well, even if you don't go back to school, how old are you going to be 5 years from now? That isn't going to change. 5 years from now, you're going to be 5 years older. You know, what are you going to do during that 5 years? And so I didn't go to get a degree, and I never did. I just took some courses. I wanted to learn, you know, I took humanities, I took psychology, I took French, I took Spanish. I just wanted to challenge myself, because at that point I had gotten into self-development and personal growth. And so I saw college as a amazing petri dish to do this journey of personal growth in. I didn't see it as an academic thing or a way of getting a degree or anything. You know, I've actually had two different colleges offer me honorary degrees, right, since then. And I don't even take them. I'm like, thanks, I appreciate it, I'm honored your offer, but it's just, you know, I wouldn't even put the diploma up. I have artwork in my house. I don't have plaques and award. When I win a plaque or an award, I take it, I give it to these little youth football and baseball teams I sponsor, and they change the plates and they give it away to their kids. I'm not that stuff. I don't live for that stuff. You know, I lived for the learning. And so, I couldn't, again, at that age, at that level of sophistication, I probably couldn't articulate it. But it's the, you know, if you look behind me, you can see that's the cover of my last book, Radical Rebirth. And that, I feel, is like the culmination of all my life's work, all put together. Because what I have learned along this journey is, if you hate your life, even if you hate yourself, you don't have to kill yourself. And believe me, I almost did. But I learned, no, I can kill off the parts of myself that I don't like. And I can recreate. I can regrow. I can have a rebirth. And so that's really, that's the theme of the book, and that's really been my MO for life, work, success, is I just want to keep moving toward that highest possible version of myself. And it started with having to kill off parts of me I didn't like. And then I think as you get further along the journey, as you get, you know, further, more advanced on the path of enlightenment, then you don't have to kill off bad parts of you that you're running away from. You get to move toward higher versions of yourself that you're running toward. And that's what I think the real journey, the mystery of life, the joy of life, that's what I think it's really about.
And, you know, whenever we sort of talk about human performance, and I'm a big advocate of everything that you know, you've talked about on your own journey, like learning and challenging yourself and continuing to you know, learn as you grow. In terms of how you kind of go about that, tell me a little bit about sort of how habit and routine can really help you to, as you say, kill off elements of yourself that you don't like and build sort of a new self almost that is going to be much better.
I'm just totally a routine guy. I've found that really that's where my breakthrough productivity lives. I'm a total creature of habit. So I wake up and I go down and I do cardio first thing in the morning. Now, I'm not one of these people that gets the runner's high and love to be on the tread. I hate that shit. I hate it. I do treadmill. I do the elliptical. I do the stationary bike. I do the spinning bike. I do, you know, different stuff each day. I can't stand it, but I put on a podcast of something I want to learn, something that'll cause me to grow. So that will take my mind off of the exercise, and I do it. And because I don't like doing cardio, but I hate being out of shape. I hate being overweight. I hate not having enough energy that I need to get through my day. When I lost that restaurant the second time when the IRS came and seized it, I can tell you the real reason I lost that restaurant is because my health was so miserable. And that's why I couldn't keep up. And that's why I never got ahead and never got those taxes paid. I had systemic candidiasis, you know, where the bad bacteria in your gut is just overpopulated because, you know, I had moved out of the house when I was 16. We're going through all that stuff. My poor mother didn't know what to do to handle me, right? So I'm in jail and armed robbery and everything. And so I just said, I just want to live by myself. You know, and she's like, okay, you think you could do that? You know, figuring I'd be back in 3 days, but I never went back. Right. But what do you do when you're a 16-year-old living by yourself? All you eat is cake and cookies and pizza and soda and cigarettes. And, you know, I mean, so from being 15 to 30, I ate the most tragic, horrific, terrible diet. And of course, my health reflected that. And so that was kind of a turning point for me. I always said, God, if I could just get healthy, if I could just get my body to keep up with my mind, I really feel I could do amazing things. And so that's, you know, how the routines came about is I realized, I need to be healthy. I like to play softball. I still do to this day. I'm in competitive leagues, right? Well, if I don't do cardio, if I don't do resistance training, I'm not flexible. I'm not strong. I don't have my energy that I need to play softball at a high level. So I have my routine. And if I don't do cardio in the morning, I feel like I haven't brushed my teeth. If I don't do my resistance work, I feel dirty. I feel like, again, I didn't brush my teeth or I didn't take a shower for a month or I don't know. It's just because I've made it the routine. And it doesn't start that way. Everybody listening to this or watching this knows you don't start that way, right? Those first days, you start a new exercise program or you start a new way of eating, any kind of really behavioral lifestyle change, you got to make it a habit. And if you get through, you know, and you hear different things, 30 days, 3 weeks, whatever, but we know that somewhere in that time frame, it does fall into place where it just becomes a habit where you feel worse by not doing it than you do by doing it. Right. And so I start with my cardio and I have my self-development time and then I'll do a little more self-development time, usually like reading first thing in the morning. Then I mix up my protein shake and everything, and I have that. Then I come into my office. I will check the overnight what come in, because I do business in Asia and Russia and you know, Europe and a lot of places around the world. I have interest. So I just see, is there some five alarm fire that came in overnight that I need to deal with? And if so, I'll handle that. But if not, I don't answer all those emails. I'll just run through, okay, is there some five alarm fire here I need to know about? And then I write. You know, my morning is my best writing time. So I do that in the morning, midday. Then I go back down to the gym and I do my resistance training. Then I come back and I have my egg white omelet, right? Every day. Okay, I have the same protein shake every morning after my cardio. I have the same egg white omelet after my resistance training. Why? Because that's another decision I don't need to make. So instead of every day say, okay, what should I have for breakfast this morning? No, I know what my breakfast is. I don't need to waste any mental energy on that. What am I going to eat after my workout? I don't have to make that decision. I made the decision one time, and then that decision is made for the next 10,000 times, right? So that's where routines can be helpful in that sense. Then I'll come back. And then it's the time to kind of follow up, return phone calls, answer emails, stuff like that. You know, and so I've got like my day, and my week is the same way. I have my newsletter, which email newsletter goes out every Friday. I call it Friday Philosophy. And so, you know, by Wednesday, I need to be thinking about what that is. I've been doing a prosperity live stream on Saturday. So I have that during. So like during the week, I know when I need to be working on my podcast, my blog, my newsletter. You know, it's all routines to me.
And do you do anything in terms of, you know, blocking out those chunks in your diary, particularly things like writing, where, you know, I'm a big fan of kind of author Stephen Pressfield and the book The War of Art, where, you know, a lot of what he says is you've kind of got to cut yourself off and really have sort of deep focus if you want to create or write or you know, I know for you with consistency and doing your live streams, your YouTube and things is amazing, that just the kind of consistency you've done for that. Are there any kind of little tips or tricks for anyone listening or watching, or is that now so natural for you, just do it?
Well, this mug you see me holding up is the mug created by that guy that Steve Pressfield worked with when his last book came out about the, you know, the warrior, the Roman warrior. And this was so he sent me this as a gift for people who who haven't seen my YouTube channel. It's called Prosperity TV. I have two interviews I did with Stephen Pressfield. Okay. I believe Stephen is the greatest living writer in America today, or maybe even English speaking writer today. So I did two different interviews with him about creativity and writing. So anyone who's interested in those, you've got to go see those videos. The thing I block off each week is thinking time. Writing, in essence, I've already blocked it off because that's the first thing I do, right? I have a newsletter I write, I have blog posts I write, and I write books. So there's always some writing that I need to do. And I write every day because writers write. That's what they do. If you're not writing every day, you're not really a writer. And if you're not writing every day, you can't be good at it. So in essence, that's how I start my work day every day. So I don't, you know, in one way it is blocked off and I don't, you know, answer the phone and do email and stuff when I'm writing. When I'm writing, I'm writing. But I do know that you do 50 minutes of high concentration, mental anything, you need a break, right? You have circadian rhythms that you go through. And after 50 minutes, so I don't mind if I write really strong for 50 minutes and then I'll go. I know I have that email in my box that somebody was asking me about being on a podcast in Lithuania on Tuesday, and I can respond to that because I need to take a break from the writing. That's when I'll get up and go and make another cup of tea and come back, whatever. But the thing I block off every week that I think is different from most people is I block off thinking time. And I just There's no devices. I take a journal, a pen, a cup of green tea, and I'll sit and think for 45 minutes and just think about what I'm thinking about and what do I need to be thinking about. And I really recommend that practice for everybody. I think they'll find real breakthroughs with it. But that's an important routine for me every week.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's really interesting. I tend to block off, part of my Friday afternoons actually to kind of reflect back on the week and think about sort of strategy for our business and also, myself kind of personally and sort of personal development and things like that. And I think it's something that I started doing a little while ago now, and it's so important, particularly on, when you're doing things that are sort of very, very busy or you're managing people or your head's down, doing things like writing or, publishing any type of learning material, just having that sort of almost like kind of self-care reflective time is really important. I was just wondering what on that sort of side of, the mental aspects of sticking with routines or going through challenging times, what's your sort of thoughts on the mental aspect of how you can, push through and in terms of human performance, reach kind of peak performance?
Everything is mental, right? It just, there are certain first principles, right? If you say everything is about sex, right? That's like a universal principle. There's this human sexual urge, sexual energy, which Napoleon Hill wrote about in Think and Grow Rich, right? So you could say everything is about sex except sex, because sex is about power, right? And we say sex is about power. What is that? That's because sex is really about the mental aspect of sex. Even though there's all that physical stimulation, it's really a mental game, right? And I can tell you, having won gold medals and World Series in softball, it's 95% mental. And having written New York Times bestsellers and being in the Speaker Hall of Fame and the Direct Selling Hall of Fame and, becoming a multimillionaire, and all of that is 95% mental. Because everything grows from that. It's how, because everything is how we perceive the world, right? You have to be careful when you speak in absolute. So when you say everything is mental, obviously there's always exceptions to every rule, and speaking in absolutes is catchy and soundbitey and might get us clicks in an article or something, but we need to be discerning enough. It's okay to say, because I was having this conversation on my blog the other day, because I was talking about how things are not good or evil. It's the way we assign them. Like tonight, I have two softball games, right? So if it rains tonight, I will assign rain as bad, because that means my games got rained out. But for the guy who has a garden, he's going to assign rain as good, because yes, my tomatoes and my carrots and my beets need rain for the garden to flourish, right? Rain isn't good or bad. We assign those things to it, right? And now, again, the conversation I was having on my blog was, guys, well, what about the Nazis? Okay, no, we can say, all right, it's safe to say, we can just say Nazis are evil. Okay, that's an exception. There are things that are pure evil or pure angelic, right? So again, absolutes don't serve us. But for the most part, it's really a solid foundation to work from, is that everything begins with your mental state, your mindset, and how you choose to view things, right? When my restaurant was seized, I thought it was the most devastating thing that ever happened in my life. But it was one of the greatest gifts that I ever had. When I got shot and left for dead, that kind of sucked, right? That was a miserable time in my life. Now I would tell you that's the greatest gift that I ever had in my life, because I never take sunrises and sunsets for granted. I never take relationships for granted. I don't take my health for granted. I don't take my life for granted. But I had to almost lose it to gain that perspective and create the mindset that really serves me.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's what, you know, what the things that you do, like sort of writing about some of these experiences and how people can better themselves, and equally things like, you know, this podcast, a lot of, you know, what we're doing here is sort of giving people that perspective, a little bit like, you know, when you read in the newspaper, someone going through sort of similar struggles, and that gave you almost like the permission perhaps, or just understanding that if someone else could do it, that then you yourself could do it, right? And you, having been through these kind of amazing experiences and then, you know, found the success that you have in writing and in coaching and in speaking, what are some of the things that you think are the most important for anyone kind of listening who might be going through either similar struggles or just who's wanting to better themselves and reach that level of sort of health, wealth, love and happiness?
You have to accept your abundance. You can't be treated for prosperity. You have to be open to receive it. So one of the basis of that Radical Rebirth book of mine is you look at the six main areas you create beliefs in your life: God and religion, work and career, sex and sexuality, health and wellness, marriage and relationships. Right. And look at what are your core foundational beliefs in each of those areas? And then how did you get those beliefs? When did you get them? And do those beliefs serve you? And when I say that book is like the culmination of all my work in my life, because that's where I'm tying it all together and breaking it down and kind of reverse engineering the process of here's how you create a meaningful life and success and happiness. Because if you're, you know, pick any one of those six categories, health, you know, marriage and relationships. If your parents fought all the time, if one cheated on the other, if one was abusive to the other, you have a core foundational belief about marriage. And you don't even realize you do unless you ask that question. And then you say, well, when did I get that belief? You know, what's my belief? Well, my belief is marriage is a tug of war and there's a lot of bickering and a lot of arguing and put downs and there's some power plays and, you know, it's very chaotic. And okay, when did I get that? Well, I got it when I was 6 years old watching my parents. So now I'm 45 years old and I'm playing out the same script in my own marriage. Yeah, that's usually the answer. You are, because you never went back and questioned that premise, which is, what is my core foundational belief about marriage and relationships? When did I get it? And does it serve me? We can do the same, you know, health and, you know, why did I eat nothing but cake and cookies and pizza and every, you know, yeah, granted, that's what kids do if left to their own devices. But that's also beliefs that I picked up from my family. My family ate that kind of garbage all the time. And that's, you know, so my family is, I think the beliefs in my family about wealth, I'm sorry, about health and wellness are probably the same as most people here in the US, most people there in the UK, most people everywhere in the world, which is okay, you gain an extra 5 to 10 pounds for every decade you get older. And by the time you're 50 or 60, you probably have 10 or 12 prescriptions that you have to take on a daily basis to stay alive. And that's what health means. Well, did you ever question that premise? Did you ever say, where did I get that belief? Does that belief serve me? So that's where I would tell people to start, is go back. You know, if you haven't read the book, that's, you know, Radical Rebirth is, you know, I hate people who just shill their books all the time. That's really not my intent here, but I really honestly, earnestly, sincerely believe that's a book that can help people transform their life. And the reason is because I'm going to tell you the truth. You know, I'm going to get up in your grill and challenge you and cause you to question your foundational beliefs. And that's just not a common thing, right? Most authors or speakers or gurus or coaches, they're going to pander to their audience. They're going to tell them the things they want to hear. And I don't do that. I don't believe that serves anybody. So what I'm doing in my work, whether it's my live streams or my podcasts or my book, is, you know, I'm getting up in your face and saying, let's really question this premise. Is this serving you? And I think most people, if they go through the process they talk that I describe in the book, they will come to the understanding they have very toxic, dysfunctional beliefs about relationships. They have very toxic, dysfunctional beliefs about health and wellness. They've probably been programmed by organized religion and government and what I call the datasphere, that money is bad and rich people are evil. It's spiritual to be poor, to be successful in business, you've got to be a horrible parent. To have a successful company, you need to exploit workers and plunder the environment. Those are the main mind viruses that are circulating in the world today. And if you don't go up to 30,000 feet and look down on yourself with enough self-awareness to really question the premises, you'll just go along in the flow of the river of mediocrity that most of the world is in right now.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, that element of sort of social conditioning and you know, lots of people walking through kind of life almost like in a daze until they come to these life-changing events like many people have, that's normally the kind of wake-up call, certainly when I've sort of spoken to or coach people. And you know, I think around some of the topics you're touching on there, like any kind of coach, any high performance coach, yes, they need to obviously kind of support whoever they're working with, or, you know, an athlete in sort of sports and things and believe in them and their ability. But they've also got to call them out, as you say, on certain things that they're, you know, think is true, but is not necessarily, which might be like a limiting belief. But for anyone kind of, you know, listening, how can anyone sort of, you know, at home really kind of look introspectively and develop that self-awareness? Because, you know, for lots of people, when they start questioning things themselves, it's a difficult thing to do, right? You know, that you're going against your own kind of thought space, your own ego, and you're challenging everything that sort of, you know, wraps your reality. Have you got any sort of tips from having kind of coached people where people could maybe start upon that journey?
Yeah, come and see me, randygage.com. I will force you to look at that stuff, right? You will adore me or you will despise me, right? And that choice is going to be up to you. But if you go to randygage.com, there's a link to my podcast. I do a couple each week. There's a link to my blog. You'll see my books. You'll see my prosperity live streams that I've been doing on Saturdays, right? Dip your toe in the water, listen to a couple podcasts, check out a couple blog posts, and I will force you to look at some of those core foundational beliefs you have. Or you'll just say, oh, no, this guy scares the hell out of me. I don't want to go anywhere near him. I want to retreat back to my life of mediocrity in my comfort zone. And whichever decision you make is totally up to you, but you know, it's not my job to make you better, force you to do anything. I put my work out there. Other people, you put your work out there, right? We put our work out there, and so people can go to the buffet and sample some different flavors and see what might work for them. And that's really what my work is about. Is I'm trying to show people the pathway for how you become the highest possible version of yourself.
Yeah, that's absolutely awesome and perfectly on point. And as we sort of start to wrap up, at the end of all of these podcasts, I always ask everyone to give who their human performance hero is. And I'd be super interested to hear who yours is, Randy.
I would have to say my mother. What I, you know, when I think of what I put that poor woman through, as you know, in jail for armed robbery, if you know, and the drugs and the alcohol and all of that. Here she was trying to raise three kids. She, my mother raised three kids knocking on doors selling Avon products.
Wow.
And I don't mean like the gals today who like work in an office and take in an Avon catalog and say, hey, this is my side hustle. You know, if you'd like to buy some mascara. No, my mom went around and knocked on doors to sell Avon because that's what you did back then. And she raised three kids doing that. And the guts and determination and resilience. I mean, she was teaching us lessons that we had no idea we were learning at that time, right? But the guts and determination and grit that she demonstrated, you know, of just doing what she had to do to take care of her family. That's heroic to me. So she would be my number one hero.
No, that's a fantastic example. And as we sort of end out the podcast, we've obviously already touched on, you know, some of the amazing stuff you do. But if people do want to, you know, connect with you on YouTube or your website, where can they go to find out more?
Yeah, so randygage.com is kind of my Starfleet command site that will take you to everything that I do. And the place where I really engage with people is Twitter. So if you want to have a conversation and debate an issue of the day with me, that would be the place to do it.
Amazing. Well, Randy, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. And I think, you know, everyone listening will have got some real motivation to start looking at how they can change their life and really kind of reconfigure everything they're doing. Wish you all the best with everything else on the remainder of your journey. And thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, Alex, it's been great having the conversation with you.